Thank you, Rebecca. So I imagine that most of you are familiar with this report, so I'm going to go through it quickly to make sure we have time for other speakers and for questions. But I have no financial relationships disclosed, and I want you to know everything I say here is my opinion and not that of the Pew Charitable Trust. And I also want to acknowledge you've met Rebecca. Rebecca did 95% of the work on this report. Jane Koppelman and I helped her. But we also want to acknowledge the support we got from Chris Wood and Kathy Phipps of the Association of State and Territorial Dental Directors, who assisted us with data collection and interpretation, and then the other names you see here, people that gave us advice, guidance, and review. Pew's effort is now 7 years old, multifaceted, promoting policies related to water fluoridation, financing of care, better utilization of the dental workforce, and school-based sealant programs, which is really a combination of workforce and financing policies. And as Rebecca said, the purpose of the 2015 report was basically to repeat a 2013 report because so many states had taken efforts to improve various aspects of their program that they wanted to get credit, if you will. And those of you that were in the last session, we had an excellent question asked about, well, why don't you have report cards as a way of calling attention to the efforts of states? And this is really related to that, not only to provide grades, which provides kind of an opportunity to get people's attention, but to have a report that goes with that. And so, you know, we've heard a lot about health literacy at this meeting and elsewhere. There's no dental people at the Pew Charitable Trust. I'm an advisor to that campaign. Between the people at the Children's Dental Policy Group and the Communications Division, which have, you know, primary responsibility for this report, their literacy is oriented to what policymakers are thinking. And so when you look at the wording of this report, it very much is how you would explain the importance of school-based sealant programs to people that don't have any dental background, which is actually the most important people to reach with a policy report like that. So this report then becomes a tool for state dental directors. We have the grade to get the attention of the media and policymakers, and then you have explanations of the programs themselves and the policies that make a difference in terms that they can understand. We had four benchmarks. I'll discuss each one of those. As I said, we got support from ASTDD. They conducted a survey of state dental directors and state dental boards, boards of examiners, the licensing groups, the groups who are required to implement the state dental practice acts. And then collectively, we tried to adjudicate disagreements. And you'd be surprised, might or might not be surprised at how many times there was disagreement, even among people in the state, as to just what the law required. And then we also used information for the National Oral Health Surveillance System, which many of you know provides state-specific information about the prevalence of sealants. We made a decision to use the grading scheme identical to the 2013 report so that people didn't feel like we were moving the goalposts for the reference. That doesn't mean the indicators we used were perfect or the grading scheme was perfect, but it was really important to honor this need for people to be able to show progress against the previous standard. And then one thing that was new about this survey, we asked an open-ended question. We had gotten some feedback the first time that, well, we really weren't capturing some of the challenges that these programs face. So we had an open-ended survey question basically asking the state dental directors, is there anything else that's impeding your progress, particularly policy-related issues that are impeding your progress? And for those states then, while we didn't change the grading scheme, we gave them a minus. Again, minus sign to draw the attention to there's something else to be discussed here. So benchmark one was to see how well the states were doing in reaching all the high needs schools. We focused only on first molars. Those would be grade schools, you know, K-6 in most states, schools, and we let the state define what was a high need school. In general, high-need schools are those where 50% or more of the students are on the National School Lunch Program. But again, the states define what the high-need schools were. One of the things we learned, again, relevant to the last panel discussion, was that many states had difficulty answering this question. In other words, their capacity for public health surveillance wasn't strong enough for them to be out and able to answer this question. This is not a question what proportion of schools have state-run programs or state-financed programs. It was merely what proportion of schools have programs. Now, nobody would question the need for a state to know what proportion of their population are on community water fluoridation, or more importantly, what proportion of water systems or which water systems have fluoridated water. And it is just as important to know which of the high-need schools have school-based sealant programs. Benchmark number two was related to the efficiency of these programs. We know from the experience of several decades in many states that hygienists can completely operate these programs, operating under general or public health supervision from dentists that might be either in practice or in a governmental program. But the important thing is the clinical decision, the clinical observations about whether a child needs a sealant or not can be done by the hygienist. They can place the sealants. And in fact, it complicates programs to have a dentist examine the child first. It complicates scheduling, and it also increases the cost of the program. So we graded the types of restrictions states had and kind of graded that from most severe to ones that were not as severe to others that we felt provided no barriers at all. The third was whether the state collected could they say the prevalence of sealants in their state? And the way that is done is by using the basic screening survey and submitting data to the National Oral Health Surveillance System. Again, working with ASTDD, we were able to even find states that had reports that hadn't yet been posted on the CDC website but had been completed. And then we graded the states for when they met the Healthy People 2010 sealant objective was for 50% of the children in third grade or 8-year-olds to have at least one sealant. And we used the 2010 sealant objective because, again, we didn't want to change the goalposts. This was the benchmark for the earlier report, and it's the benchmark for this report. Another reason to use the Healthy People 2010 objective is that I know of no state that can actually answer the question of what have they met the Healthy People 2020 objective, which is an entirely different denominator. So again, this is did they meet the objective of 50% or more children? There's a subpart to the Healthy People 2010 goal, which is have you eliminated disparities? Not only have you reached 50% prevalence, but have you eliminated disparities? Many states have, but again, to not change the grading, this report merely notes that several states have, and we think that's a really significant accomplishment when they've eliminated disparities by income or race with sealant programs, but we kind of leave it to the state to promote that themselves rather than highlight it in our report. We spotlight in a sidebar, a separate page, two states that we think really provided leadership, kind of those kind of best practices, examples that we want people to see. One was the state of Washington and the other the state of Ohio, and Dr. Casamassimo will be talking more about that in just a few minutes. And so the result, after you grade on those four benchmarks, have a certain weighting for each one, is to grade the states. I would say that the important thing about grading the states is the opportunity to talk about it. Really, one could argue about the benchmarks, they could argue about how many points were assigned, how the points were weighed, and things like that. I think most people would agree in general that from top to bottom, we probably got it right, but whether a state deserves an A or a B or a C or a D really isn't as important as using this report as an opportunity to get people's attention and begin to explain to them why they want to improve programs in their state. The most common reason for a minus, in other words, the open-ended question asked of a state dental director, was there anything else that's impeding progress? Most of them were various kinds of Medicaid payment policies, and we've outlined a few here. not all of which, you know, are easily resolved. But again, there's enough in common that I think it would be our hope that before the next time we review this, that we may be able to get some resolution of some. An example of resolution, when we did the 2013 report, there was still this, quote, free care rule. It turned out that there never was a free care rule of the Center for Medicaid Services that related to whether you could bill Medicaid in a program where you were also providing some services for free. That absence of a free care rule was clarified by CMS during this two-year period. And so that's an example of sometimes we can, by calling attention to these policies, we can get a resolution to them, and we hope we can for these as well. And then another barrier that was identified, even where states had practice acts that allowed hygienists to make the sealant decision as long as they were working under a collaborative agreement with the dentist, some states had trouble finding dentists willing to collaborate. So they might have one part of the state where well covered, and other areas where the dentists in that particular region weren't supportive of this, and so then therefore the hygienists had difficulty finding ones to set up that agreement. We've been doing these sealant programs for 30 plus years in this country. During that time, we've learned a lot. We have better equipment. We've learned how to operate the programs. During that period of time, we figured out that, you know, we need to have more infection control, and we've incorporated that into the equipment and into our practices. We know more about tooth decay, dental caries, if you will. And we have better materials, and we know how the materials operate. So really, with this advance in science and understanding, we ought to make some changes. And one of the changes that we were able to make was the 2009 CDC recommendations. The earlier recommendations, if you look at that, okay, to your far left, sound and non-cavitated lesions. There was a time when the protocols for school sealant programs were only seal sound teeth and refer everybody else to a dentist for further care. In 2008, the American Dental Association issued sealant recommendations acknowledging that when you seal teeth with non-cavitated lesions, in other words, decay's there, but there isn't a hole in the tooth, there isn't a cavity, that you can seal those as well, and that stops the progression of disease. So based on that finding, that you could seal both sound and non-cavitated lesions, the decision tree is different, as this one here. But the other thing that was noted by the CDC expert panel was for cavitated lesions, while it is true that you would refer the child for further care, you should at least consider whether there's some interim management strategies. And so I want to talk a little bit more about what that might be. We, again, a sidebar, kind of a separate little story within the report, talks about how advances in science really make possible more effective sealant programs. So here's the reality. By the time a child is seen, usually in second grade, some teeth have cavitated lesions in their permanent molars. And while all children receive referrals for further care, in this case restorative care, less than half do so within 1 year. Some programs have really tried exceptional efforts to try to get kids into care and find that in spite of their best efforts, many children do not get the necessary follow-up care. So that means many children aren't going to be taken to the dentist until they have symptoms or the cavity is large. And really, I don't think any dentist wants to treat a child that's symptomatic. I mean, you're already behind the eight ball if the cavity is so large they're having problems. So what does the research demonstrate? Well, we have a material that is actually as old as sealant programs, but hasn't been used in sealant programs until relatively recently, in the United States at least, called glass ionomer. Very different kind of material than we've used for resin sealant programs. But glass ionomer restorations can be placed without anesthesia or drilling using hand instruments alone. In the rest of the world, they call this the atraumatic restorative technique. Again, it's been used for at least a couple of decades. The nature of glass ionomer is that it adheres to both enamel and dentin, and it releases fluoride. The American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry recognizes this type of restoration as an interim therapeutic restoration. It's the same technique, everything about it's the same, but it has a different title in the United States. Long-term studies, and in long-term for restorative restoration studies is really 2 years. It's really quite unusual to study restorations longer than 2 years, but some do. Failure rates of ITRs are comparable to amalgam restorations over periods of 1 to 6 years. These ITRs prevent further progress of decay and maintain function. Nothing prevents a dentist, nothing either technically in terms of taking out the filling and putting in an amalgam or a more traditional restoration, nor do Medicaid rules prevent dentists who sees a child later at any point after that ITR is placed from placing a traditional filling and getting paid to do so. And we know from the recent experiences in California that hygienists can be trained to place ITRs. The citations for all of these statements about the research are in the Pew report. So, what are the implications of this, putting this advancements of science into practice? Well, we can't put these advances into practice without changing state practice acts. And I think we won't change state practice acts until we decide that an important objective is reducing the prevalence of untreated cavities in permanent teeth. We can't just have an objective that we want to see all kids. We also need to take seriously an objective to reduce the prevalence of untreated cavities and permanent teeth. So what's the future? As I said, there's many other indicators. One of the things that constrains such reports is, what can you tell us about all states? What data are available for all states so all states can be graded? But I've suggested some here. Hopefully people will suggest others. In my dream of all dreams, as you look at the last bullet there, I would love if we had a clinical data system, an electronic health record, that it would allow any dentist that sees a child to be able to see what treatment they had received in the past. So when that child comes to the dentist, they can look at that sealant that doesn't look quite the same and know whether an ITR was placed or a traditional sealant, and so they could just proceed with their treatment and celebrate the fact that a child came to them without any symptoms, and with knowing that we had stopped decay before it progressed further. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here, and this is my first APH meeting. And it's pretty overwhelming for an old guy, so I was going to tell you that. So I would tell you that Bill sent me an email, and he said, I've talked to Carrie Farquhar. You all know Carrie, I think, and she couldn't come. And then he talked to Dave Olshani, who's the executive director of the Ohio Dental Association, and he has the ADA meeting coming up, so he couldn't do it. And so I'm the third string, but if you follow Ohio State football, you know that the third string quarterback at Ohio State is still a pretty good choice. Okay. So, I come to this, huh?
No DUIs.
No DUIs, yeah. Did I have to disclose that? No. Okay. So I had the pleasure of being involved with the ODA, and it just finished as president of the ODA, and so I felt like I could talk about this, and this is really a story. This is a story of how, you know, to try to make this work in those states where there is this more rigorous oversight, and how you can kind of turn the tide by good use of science. So it's a story. I thank Carrie Farquhar for assistance. She provided me with some slides, beginning right here, and you all know Mark Siegel as well, who really is Mr. Sealant in Ohio. So the two of them can deserve all the credit for our program here that we have in Ohio. So you can read the statistics. We get to a lot of kids in Ohio. We target high-risk kids based on the lunch program, Medicaid, or just a lack of insurance. One of the reasons that we were able to turn this, and I think Bill mentioned this, was because in Ohio, the dentists in those locales that are involved with the program are real big supporters of the program. And so it's not like they're, you know, they're fighting in those communities to not have the programs there. Once they know what's going on, they're by and large supportive of the program. So about 50% of our third graders have sealants. Pretty good program. And so, again, I would give credit to the Ohio Department of Health for their tremendous efforts in this regard. So the issues for organized dentistry and the practicing profession were these issues, and Bill alluded to some of them. One was this fear of sealing in decay, and that you know, that would be a problem, and that sooner or later this kid would show up at an office or a clinic or an ED and with a swollen face because the sealant sealed in decay and it just got worse. It couldn't drain or whatever. Then the other one, which we heard a lot, was missing existing caries on kids, and a not so major one, because in some of these areas these kids didn't seek dental care, would be conflict with existing providers in terms of who's going to be doing this and not doing it. And then the issue that Bill talked about, not referring kids with disease when in fact we know that was that was being done, and not very successfully in Ohio because of our distribution of workforce and so on. And then, of course, there was the issue with the hygiene supervision was a turf issue. And to some degree, and it you know, just for your information, right now a debate is going on in the Ohio legislature about nurse practitioners. And it's very similar to that, you know, extending their independence to be able to provide better access of care. So it's not just a dental issue. So we needed to somehow bridge this gap between science and what was perceived or lack of knowledge on behalf of the people, and it was really the leadership of the Dental Association to some degree. So historically, in our state, sealant programs had dentists examine patients. And we got into a discussion, and it was myself, and some of you may know Henry Fields, who's a former dean at Ohio State, and very active in the association in terms of access to care. And we began these negotiations in trying to find some way to be able to say, okay, let's not sever this tether totally between the dentist in that community or a dentist in the community and the program, but at the same time give the hygienist the opportunity to be independent and not to have a dentist come in with the cost and the scheduling and all this other stuff. And so we spent a few hours with Mark Siegel and the attorney for the Ohio Department of Health, or one of the attorneys, wordsmithing and in some sessions that probably made the Iran nuclear deal look like a piece of cake. And it wasn't until, you know, we finally were able to convince the leadership of the ODA based on the science that was out there that, in fact, you could, all of the things that were feared, all of the things that were thought about the sealant programs by those who didn't know well, really were not true. And so that was really the first step, and that was the breakthrough, I think. This slide just shows the distribution of the sealant programs, and it's that crescent, southeastern Ohio crescent, is, I think, again, why many of the dentists had some concern, because that's really our high caries area, that in some inner city areas in Ohio that we really are concerned about decay, and the idea that a sealant could in fact preclude decay in a population, really, I don't know that was well understood. So I think the things, for those of you who come from states where you have to do this, we were committed as a organized dental leadership to try to find a solution. And we were given evidence, and the evidence is listed down there at the bottom. Bill showed some of those, or referred to some of those. And then the benefits, the kids that were getting sealants and the decay rate, if you go to your third, I think it's your third benchmark, we don't, Carrie Farquhar will be the first to say that we can't say that the decline in caries in these populations is attributed to sealants, but it is. Okay. So there is some benefit out there that's really hard to discount. And then there really is no harm. I mean, that's that. And when we talk about evidence today and outcomes and benefits, we always talk about harm. And there really is no harm in changing it, which led us to do that. So to solidify this change, one of my colleagues, Homa Amini, I don't know if any of you know Homa, she's a pediatric dentist with an MPH, she took on the job of training the crew in Ohio and put together the elements of the training program, which I won't go into on the right there, and gave a didactic and a clinical training program that was a lot of quality assurance and looking at intraoperator reliability. And the Ohio Department of Health assured us that this would continue on. The manual was looked at and developed using some of Larry's information to provide some assurance that, in fact, these programs would continue to assess quality over time. So, I don't know what you'd call it. One of the outcomes of this was a law that was just passed in Ohio, and it's right now in our black hole of regulation development in the state. But this carried over into private practice and into other areas of auxiliary function. And so the ODA saw this worked, it was good, and so let's do some more of it. And so those are some of the things in this House Bill 463 that are now being implemented in the state of Ohio to make it even more likely that hygienists can practice and EFTAs can practice to the fullest extent of their training. And that's it.
Good afternoon. I'm also a first-time APHA-er, so I'm excited to be here as well. I just said that because you guys clapped for him, so I figured it was easy applause before I even get started. My name is Matt Crispine. I'm the Associate Director at Children's Health Alliance of Wisconsin. Just some quick disclosures. I also serve as the chair of the Children's Dental Health Project Sealant Work Group, and I'm a member of the ADA Expert Panel on Sealant Clinical Practice Guidelines, along as being a Board of Trustee member on the American Dental Hygienists Association. But I'm here today representing Children's Health Alliance, and we, in collaboration with the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin, manage a very large, robust school-based dental sealant program that goes across the state of Wisconsin. And so I'm here to share with you a little bit today about our program and some of the policies that have changed and some of the measures that we've looked at to use data to drive our change and to evaluate change, but also to continually improve and expand our program. So we were one of the five states that received an A, and as someone said before, it's great when you get an A, and it's probably great when you get an F because things change, and it's not so good when you get a C. And the other thing it's not so good at is when your grade changes, especially when you get an A. So when this report was getting ready to come out, we were a little nervous to make sure that we stayed at that A level. I'm a little nervous, to be honest, that we may not stay at that A level the next time because of some additional restrictions that could potentially be placed on us in Wisconsin. Our Board of Dentistry is looking at what I would consider a little over-regulation of our sealant programs that we're trying to work through some of those issues currently. But just to kind of give you a little bit of an overview of our program, Children's Health Alliance of Wisconsin, it's important for you to understand that we're actually affiliated with Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, and we manage six other health initiatives outside of oral health. So we're doing work in early literacy, asthma, injury prevention and child death review, as well as emergency medical services for children and the others that you see represented here by the logos. When it comes to oral health, we have four key initiatives. The Wisconsin Seal a Smile program, which is what I'm here to talk to you about today. We also manage and facilitate the Wisconsin Oral Health Coalition. And then we run a program called Earlier is Better, which is focused on home visitation with early Head Start. And our newest initiative is the Healthy Smiles for Mom and Baby Project, which is a HRSA-funded initiative. We're one of the 11 states that were funded for expanding and improving oral health of pregnant women and infants. So all of our program staff are working on a variety of issues surrounding oral health, but I just wanted to kind of lay that foundation and give you the background of who we are. The other thing that's important to understand about the Alliance is that we're almost an indirect extension of the Department of Health Services. So we work very, very collaboratively with them on an ongoing basis in oral health and in many of our other initiatives as well. A lot of our contracts are directly with the department, sometimes directly to manage state and federal funding programs, and then we also receive some direct federal and state funding as well. The Seal a Smile program is really a joint partnership between, like I said, the Department of Health Services, and then we also have two very strong partners that are not just funders, but they're also very actively involved in the program as well, and that's Delta Dental and more recently WEA Trust, which I'll talk a little bit about their involvement towards the end of my presentation. They're a new funder, that this is the first year we've received funding from them. To go over a little bit of the landscape of what we're dealing with in Wisconsin, so just so that you understand, dental hygienists can practice independently in three settings in the state, one of those being schools. And our program currently contracts with about 40 different agencies around the state. Those include local public health departments, federally qualified health centers, independent hygienists, dentists, the only dental school in the state, as well as hospitals and health systems. So there's a variety of partners that are providing care, and I'll sort of address the FQHC question that was asked before, because we found a very strong partnership with them in our state in regards to sealant programs. So we provide care in more than 850 schools, and we consider a high-risk school one to be that has a free and reduced lunch rate of 35% and greater. So we've sort of lowered that threshold from that standard of 50%, which is what a lot of states use, primarily because we have a pretty high saturation rate in that 50% level, and so we've sort of extended that out to the 35% because we have a lot of schools in the 35 to 50% range that were already being served, and we didn't really want to take programming away from them, but there is just a real need in that area as well. We are also the primary provider of school-based care in the state, so about 85% of the school-based programming in the state is provided by us. We're really close. In fact, I told Andrew at NOHC, now we're just above that 75%. So now we get all of the marks in the Pew report. So hopefully that minus doesn't come back to bite us later. Yeah, but hopefully. So we do have some non-funded programs that do provide care in our state. Some we work very collaboratively with, and others we really struggle to get data from. This is a map that shows where we're at statewide and how much penetration we have in each individual county. So in Wisconsin, we have 72 counties. We provide care in about 60 of those counties. The darkest green are counties where all of the schools that are 35% and above have a school-based dental sealant program. Those light green ones may only need one or two more schools to be participating in order to move to that next threshold. The ones we're obviously most concerned about are those with red. I talked a little bit about using data and how the data has really driven our funding and expansion. We would not be where we're at without the robust amount of data that we collect and use and report on a consistent basis. So an example of that is if you look down in the far right-hand corner, you see that red blip. That's a county that's just north of Milwaukee County. So the yellow county just below that is Milwaukee. Milwaukee, for those that may not be aware, it's only about an hour and a half north of here. It is the fourth poorest city in the country. We have a very large number of high free and reduced lunch rate schools in that county, specifically in Milwaukee Public Schools. Our funder, Delta Dental, about 2 years ago saw that this yellow was actually a light red. We were only in about 38% of those high-risk schools. And so they provided some additional funding to do some coordinated outreach to those high-risk schools. And this is data from last year. We were in about 51%. We're now in about 77% of the high-risk schools in Milwaukee. So we're really making some headway in Milwaukee, which is a real area of need for us. So again, using this data that we were able to compile in partnership with DHS really helped, again, drive some additional funding for our program. So kind of moving on to those economics, the funding for our program has increased by more than 1,000% since 1999. When we first started, we had a small pot of money that was allocated in the state budget of $60,000. We currently have a budget of about $1 million that we distribute out to school-based programs around the state. It's important to note that we have very, very low Medicaid reimbursement rates, some of the lowest in the country. And many of our programs have found a way through using dental hygienists to become very sustainable. We have been able to, because we have a very coordinated effort statewide, we've been able to cut costs in different ways, such as through bulk purchasing. So we used to have all of our 40 programs order all of their toothbrushes individually, and we thought, well, don't you think we could probably get a little bit better deal if we bought 80,000 toothbrushes versus 40 programs buying a bunch of toothbrushes? So we've tried to find things like toothbrushes and disposables that we can work with distributors to help lower our cost and purchase in bulk that each of the individual programs buy and have sent to them individually. I wish we had the manpower to do all the ordering internally and do that, but we just don't. But just the toothbrushes alone, it saves our program about $25,000 a year by purchasing in bulk. The funding that goes to local programs is varied. It varies from $1,500 to a program all the way up to $100,000 for a different grantee. This just really shows the growth of funding, and a couple things that I think are important to point out here. So in 2006, you see is when kind of our first jump happened, and that was through some HRSA funding that again jumped in 2009. And what was important about the funding in 2009 is that the state actually allocated all of that HRSA funding to Sealants, and it was able to leverage some additional matching dollars from Delta Dental. So Delta Dental said, we'll put in $250,000 if the state increases their contribution. So we stayed steady with that till 2012. The HRSA funding ended. And I don't know how many of you have paid attention of what's gone on in our state, but in a time when our governor was cutting programs and cutting public health funding, they actually contributed additional dollars to the Sealant program because of the progress we've made and because of the impact that we've had to Sealant. So they added about $250,000 additional dollars from the state budget to the Sealant program in order to continue leveraging that match from Delta Dental. At that point, Delta said, well, the state's putting in $350,000 now, so we'll up our ante to $350,000 as well. Those last two additions you see in 14 and 15, the little small blue bars are the Milwaukee expansion, and then the red bar is the expansion from WEA Trust, which I'll talk more about in a bit. It's really focused on participation. We collect a ton of data, and I'm happy to say that, Bill, maybe your dream of monitoring whether a child has had an ITR may not be as far off as you think with the new data collection that we're using in Wisconsin, and I'm going to share a little bit about that. But obvious things you see: with more money, you're going to see more kids. You're going to be in more schools. You're going to place more Sealants. Those are obvious things. The things to point out here is that we really try to work on efficiency and making programs more cost-effective. The thing I'll point out on these graphs is that between 2009 and 2012, we didn't see any increases in funding. It stayed pretty level. The sources of funding changed, but the funding itself was pretty much stable. And you can see there was a significant increase over that time, the big jump when we started the expansion. But even after we leveled off, we continued improving efficiency and got more funding out to more programs to see more kids. It was mentioned briefly on the surveillance that's done by the state. These are the three different years when Wisconsin has done surveillance on third graders. You can see that the number of children in third grade that have untreated decay has dropped almost by half, from 31% back in 2001, down in 2012 to 17%, and inversely, you see many more children with Sealants. The biggest jump between 07 and 2012, which was when our program expanded very, very significantly. Now again, our program is not the only reason that decay has dropped and that Sealants have gone up, but it's important to just note that we've had a pretty significant impact on that. The disparity issue. We made a conscious effort in 2007 after getting this data to focus on more high-risk schools, especially those that were 75% and above. And you can see in the 2012 survey, we made a big dent in that. So we went from only 34% of third graders in those high-risk schools having dental Sealants all the way up to 60, which is right around the state average of 61. We've also used the data to help justify policy change. So we made policy changes around the ADA and CDC recommendations to make our programs more cost effective. We were able to ensure that now dental hygienists can bill Medicaid. That really, really helps with sustainability. When dental hygienists were already providing these services for schools and unable to bill for that, it was virtually impossible to sustain the program. We also made some policy changes around the types of dental sealant materials that we were using and the preparation techniques based on the recommendations. And we saw our retention data jump. We went from about 78% to when we made the change, we've been hovering right around 91 or 92% for the past 4 or 5 years since we made those changes. I talked a little bit about data. So we have a new data collection program that we're piloting. We're in year two. We're trying to work out the bugs. This is a dental sealant registry. So if any of you have immunization registries in your state, it's a very similar type of a model where programs can go in. This data is all housed at the Department of Health Services, and all of our programs have access to it and can enter in sealant information for the child. Just because of time, I just want to quickly show this is what they get in and they look at, and this is where they're actually entering the data into the program. So similar to a tooth chart that you'd see in an electronic health record, but we're really just monitoring tooth level information. Does it have decay or not? Is it filled or not? Is it sealed or not? Based on what gets entered here, again, this builds on efficiency. It's easier for programs to enter this in real time on site. It auto-generates basically like an after-visit summary that goes home with the child that tells them what they did, what teeth were sealed, what teeth have decay, what instructions they need to follow, if they had fluoride varnish or for follow-up. All of those things are built into this system. It also allows a variety of reports, and a lot of this was built on we used to use SEALS, which was developed by CDC in partnership with Wisconsin, but we found that just from a capacity standpoint, we needed something more. And so the basis of this is similar to SEALS, so it's giving us all those same metrics that we need to report to CDC, but it's being able to be collected in real time. So any of us can go in on any given day and see how many kids we've sealed, how many kids have decay, and where we're at. Lastly, some logistics. So I talked about this pilot project that we're focusing on with WEA. We found that we had a lot of schools that had low participation in the sealant program. So we were in the school, but only 20% of the kids were actually returning a consent form. So we're using this funding, and we've structured sort of a multi-tier incentive program that involves incentives for students, for teachers, for schools, to really help raise awareness about the program and help improve participation. We've developed some branding around our program, which you see on the picture there. That's a window cling that we actually have put up in all of our schools so that we're trying to get some brand recognition for these programs. We also, programs find value in being part of this statewide network. So we have programs that have become self-sustaining based on billing alone, but they choose to actually participate in our program and collect data because they want that ongoing technical assistance from our programs. We also developed a video to help school administrators better understand what a school-based sealant program might look like in their school. I'm not going to show that video today, but if you go on our website, you can see that video. It's readily available on the Wisconsin Seal Smile page. We've also tried to streamline the way we deliver care. So we've developed this administration manual using many of the tools that are out there. So the mobile portable dental guide and the best practices and evidence-based guidelines, to really put them all in one manual so that programs can agree that this is the way they're going to provide care, so that it's uniform across the state and that they're all using the most current and evidence-based practices available. And I think we're going to hold off till questions till after Larry. Again, thank you very much for your time, and happy to be here and happy to answer questions at the end.